Hello, and welcome to the Truly Amazing Women Show on the Incandescent Radio Network, the voice of entrepreneurs. In each episode of the show, we shine a spotlight on the women who are making strides and changing lives. Hello, I'm Hope Katz Gibbs, founder of the Incandescent Women's Network here and Incandescent Women Magazine, here today with the amazing Tracy Schott, a filmmaker and social worker who is the creator and producer of an amazing documentary about women and violence, domestic violence, called Finding Jen's Voice. Tracy found me on LinkedIn a few months ago. She said she wanted to tell me about this amazing project, and I was immediately, yes. How can I help you spread the word? So Tracy, welcome to the show, and thank you so much for being here. You're in Pennsylvania. I'm here in New Mexico, and we're going to talk about the work that you're doing. So tell us, how did you come to create this documentary?
In 2011, I had just started my own production company after working for somebody else for many years. And my plan was I was going to, do corporate work and be wildly financially successful. About 2 weeks after I had started my LLC, I got a phone call from a friend of mine, and she was on her way to her niece's funeral. And she told me that Jen had been murdered the week before by her married boyfriend after he learned that she was pregnant. And she wanted me to tell Jen's story. Now, I'd like to say that, I just jumped right in, but there was this part of me inside that was screaming, no, I don't do crime. That's not my thing. And when I hear the words documentary film, which is what this would have been, I know that I'm going to be fundraising, grant writing, and working for free forever. And that's exactly what happened, because while I was on the phone with Trina, I Googled pregnancy and homicide and found these horrific studies showing homicide to be a leading or even the leading cause of death to pregnant women. Now, this was shortly after the Scott and Lacey Peterson case that was in the nightly news for like 5 years. And all we heard about this case was it was an anomaly, this guy snapped, how did this happen? This, nice looking white guy somehow murdered his pregnant wife. This was so weird. Nobody talked about the research. And the reality that I came to learn was that domestic violence and violence against women actually increases during pregnancy for many, many women. Finding this statistic it floored me. And I heard these words coming out of my mouth as I was looking at this data and talking to Trina. And I said, you're right. I need to tell this story. This is awful and the world needs to know about it. And that started the journey. It took 4 years to make the film and it was released in 2015. And yes, I was fundraising and grant writing and working for free for a very long time. But it's been really gratifying for me. As you mentioned, I was a social worker by training. And so this film kind of brought me full circle in my life and joined these two seemingly disparate professions together seamlessly. So it's been a very important journey for me and for the many people who were involved in making this film.
So many questions for you now. So first question is why? When you told me about this, that, one of the top reasons for death during pregnancy is murder, it's almost impossible to believe that. So what do you think is going on?
So domestic violence and intimate partner homicide are not about violence necessarily. They're about control. Coercive control. So a domestic violence relationship, any survivor will tell you that the hardest part of being in a domestic violence relationship is not recovering from the bruises and broken bones. While that is obviously a horrible thing to have to deal with, the hardest part is to recover from the fact that somebody that you love and trust is hurting you and is going to great measures to control your life. And that's what domestic violence is about. It's about control. It's about manipulating your emotions, your behavior, your relationships with other people, so that you are kind of a pawn on a chessboard to an abuser. I interviewed many women who had been abused, and most of whom had narrowly escaped homicide themselves. And they were all very different. You know, their personalities were very different. They came from different walks of life. It was a very diverse group of people that I interviewed. But when I had them describe their abusers, they all sounded like the same person. So there's definitely a profile of somebody who is a homicidal abuser.
So what is that profile? What does that look like?
Well, the most dangerous, they're all very narcissistic. The world revolves around them. The rules don't apply to them. They've got their own set of rules. They feel very entitled to having their own set of rules. And they are also, I mean, there's definitely a sociopathic tendency there, you know. But it's frequently, you know, they can be law-abiding citizens in the rest of their lives. It's only when they come to comes to their relationships with particularly their intimate partners, but also children, that they become, you know, they show these criminal behaviors and no remorse. And among those who become homicidal, we also see this Machiavellian tendency, that the ends justifies the means, right? You know, I can move people around like pawns on a chessboard, and it's okay because as long as I win, that's all right. So it's a pretty sick personality. and not every domestic abuser is capable of premeditated homicide. But almost every abuser is a very controlling and narcissistic person who can become quite dangerous when, you know, threatened with a loss of control.
Wow. Well, I was talking to, I asked you for a handful of names of women who worked on the program with you and on the project, and you put me in touch with Dr. Ray Taylor, who's at Loyola in Louisiana. And she was telling me a story that as a social worker, as a researcher, she went into a court with one of these victims who they were both happened to be 8.5 months pregnant at the time. And this woman, she said, was so emaciated. Her boyfriend had just, the father of the baby had just beaten her senseless, and her eyes were black, so much so that she had to be guided in. Her eyes were shut from being bruised. And then she went in and the judge said to her, honey, if you just marry this man and you do the right thing, that, you know, everything will be okay. It's your fault. It's because you're, and I'm here in these beautiful robes and I will marry you today. I, you know, I have the authority to do that. And this poor woman, right, who'd just been beaten senseless, pregnant, and, you know, how shamed she was. And poor Ray said she, you know, she, because of how it worked with her job, that she didn't really get to follow up with this woman. It wasn't allowed. And just how criminal that is, right? Truly, you know, as women, it's really hard to not get furious that any woman would get hurt like that.
It is mind-bending that a judge would say that, but unfortunately, victim blaming is very common. And so many people in law enforcement really do put the onus of the crime on the victim. In fact, in many states, the criminal statutes actually put the onus of the crime and the prosecution of the crime on the victim. And, you know, there are really no other crimes where that happens. But in our society, there is still very much a belief that what happens in the home stays in the home, and it is not anybody's business to step in, and it's a relationship problem. It's not a relationship problem. It's a crime. And it's a crime that should be enforced. You know, the prevention of it should be a primary concern. But people in our society and really worldwide don't want to deal with it. And I think that, you know, it's very hard for the average person in a relationship to even wrap their heads around the idea that the person that you're sleeping next to could kill you.
But you are providing some solution. You are actively fundraising, campaigning, trying to make people more aware of this with the hope, please, you know, that this will stop if people are aware of it. I'm hoping that that's true, right? Somehow the current political situation doesn't really dictate that one thing follows the other. However, that doesn't mean we're not going to keep trying. So tell us what you're doing and how we can help.
Well, in 2015, the film was completed. It took 4 years. And I did, you know, a festival run the way, you know, normal filmmakers do. But I kept coming back to this feedback from people, particularly people who are working in the field of domestic violence, that this was an incredible tool for teaching. And I was getting phone calls from professors. I was trying to find a distributor, you know, a film distributor, and wasn't liking what was coming my way. And so I was kind of holding on to the hope that, you know, some magical distributor was going to take over and distribute the film. Meanwhile, I was getting phone calls and emails from college professors and teachers and domestic violence advocates saying, where can I buy your film? I want to show it to, you know, my students. I want to show it to the, you know, use it as a fundraiser. And so I started self-distributing DVDs. In the meantime, I kept getting phone calls and invitations to conferences to present the film and to speak about it. You know, because I have the background in social work, I kind of have this unique, you know, set of skills that allow me to do that and speak to a professional audience. But the more I talked to people, the more I realized that what we needed more than anything was for law enforcement and healthcare professionals, particularly, get this information in their hands and to use the film to teach. And that came to a really glaring example when in my own community in Reading, Pennsylvania, a couple of years ago, we had a family murder-suicide. Woman with three children was getting ready to leave her husband. And we learned later that she had contacted the police a month earlier because they'd had a horrible fight and he was threatening to kill her and she was afraid. And the police kind of patted her on the back and said, you know, it's fine. You're fine. Everything's fine. And they left. So she was leaving. She was packing her things to leave. The husband knew she was leaving and she was supposed to meet her family in Philadelphia. At her new apartment and she didn't show. And her family contacted the local police and they showed up at the house and he had lined up the wife, the three children and the family dog on the sofa, shot them all and then shot himself. And after an investigation, which implied that it could have been, the media attention implied that it could have been the mother who did this horrific act. And I was like, I will bet you that she was leaving, you know, and as the, you know, the information eked out of the press, it was clear, you know, that this was a classic case of somebody trying to leave a controlling relationship and being stopped through homicide and unfortunately took out the whole family. Wow. So I contacted the local police. And I contacted the local press and I said, I'd like to offer a free screening of my film to anybody who wants to come because I think you're missing some things. And one of the things that really stuck out was there was this article in the newspaper where the local DA said, there's nothing to be learned from this case. And I'm like, no, there is so much to be learned from this case, you know? And so we sat down and I showed the film, and there were about a dozen law enforcement, about 40 people from the local newspaper and local media. And the DA and the county detective pulled me aside afterwards and said, this needs to be shown to every police cadet. You know, this is, you had all the red flags. And if we had known this information ahead of time and acted on it, this family could still be alive. So that really motivated me to start offering training to law enforcement. And the film and law enforcement training that I developed has been approved for credit in the state of Pennsylvania. And I created an online version that anybody can access on my new website. That whole intervention with law enforcement has taken a lot of my attention. I'm now moving over into healthcare, because we know, particularly among pregnant women, that healthcare professionals are in a key place to intervene with patients. And every patient should be screened for domestic violence every time they go to the doctor. And it happens in about 10% of the time, even though every medical professional organization recommends screenings at each visit. So there's lots of work to be done. There's some very simple things that can be done that can make a huge difference.
And what are some of those? Just could you give us a quick list? What can be done? What can we look for as friends, family members, and to support these women?
So, you know, having a friend or family member who is a victim of domestic violence is, it's a really hard place to be as a friend, because it's hard to step in those shoes, right? It's hard to understand why she stays, why she goes back, why the police get frustrated when a victim calls, and they really just want the violence to stop because they're afraid, but they're more afraid to leave. Mm-hmm. And that's the piece that people have trouble understanding, that what happens when you leave? For many, many women in domestic violence relationships, the threat around leaving is real. If you leave, I will kill you. I will kill the children. I will kill the dog. I will kill myself. And she believes him. So leaving is not as easy as packing your bags. And the other thing is that usually what happens is, you know, they don't hit you on the first day. Domestic violence victims are groomed over a long period of time. And when I say groomed, what I mean is they are systematically isolated from friends and family. They are told that they're stupid, told that nobody will believe them. And a really big thing that happens is they usually lose a lot of control over their finances. So what happens when you leave and you don't have any money? How many people are willing to voluntarily become homeless and make their children be homeless and take their children out of their school districts? It's usually, for many women, it's makes more sense to just try and work it out and see if you just can't make it work, right? But if you're the mother or the sister or the best friend of somebody who's in one of those relationships and you're looking at it from the outside, it's very easy to be frustrated. So my advice is, you know, there are some wonderful national organizations and national network to end domestic violence, the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence, the National Domestic Violence Hotline. All of these have websites that have good resources for friends and family that tell you what to say and what not to say. But the main thing I want to say is just don't abandon them. Even when they do what you don't want them to do, like go back, don't abandon them. Don't say, I'm done with this. I am so over it, right? And it's easy to feel that way. I am so over this conversation. We've had it so many times and you keep going back and getting hurt, and it hurts me to see you get hurt. So I'm not even going to deal with you anymore, right? That's a normal response. And guess what? That's exactly the response that the abuser is counting on. Because the more isolated she is, the more control he has.
So it's horrifying and so prolific, right? This, and you were telling me when we were doing our pre-interview that this happens in the gay community very, very frequently as well.
Yeah, the LGBTQ numbers are even higher than that among the heterosexual population. The majority of domestic violence cases that we know about in this country are female victims, male perpetrators. Vast, 90% of the perpetrators are male. However, in the LGBTQ population, there's a very high rate of domestic violence, but it's very hard to measure because reporting rates are low. And we're just starting to wrap our heads around it. But I've seen rates of up to 40% of people in gay or lesbian relationships have experienced domestic violence, intimate partner violence in that relationship. The statistics aren't much better for heterosexual relationships. 27% of women in the U.S. will experience domestic violence in her lifetime.
Wow.
So if you're sitting in a room with, there's four women, statistically, the chances one of you is in a domestic violence relationship has been or will be.
Wow. Yeah. And if you're in a group of 100, right, 25 women are suffering like that. That is just, it's so breathtaking. I can only think that we need to band together and support you. So let's start there, because it's so much to take in at once, right? Because I think anyone with feelings, we want this to stop. We don't want anyone to grow into this. Our daughters, our sisters. It's just, how do we put an end to it, right? And not just as women supporting each other, but how do we educate men so that they don't do this, right? Because that's a whole other thing that's hard to get your brain around.
Yeah, it's a very complex subject, and a lot of it comes back to just cultural. My goal is that culturally we will end tolerance for violence against women. That's my goal. In my lifetime, I would like us to be a culture that no longer tolerates violence against women, does not make excuses for perpetrators, and does not blame victims, right? So how do we get there? One of the things that I've done in the last year, I've been working with a wonderful group out of India called One Gen, and their goal is to change the world for better in one generation, right? So they learned about Finding Jen's Voice, and they said, we want to work with you to get this word out. So we're taking a worldwide approach with my new website called Voices for Change. And so it's voices, the number 4, change.net. And Voices for Change has training on it currently for healthcare and law enforcement, hopefully more to come. It also has a lot of resources of all the various organizations that are out there. I also have a discussion forum in which I invite experts in the film, in the field to, some of them are in the film, to share their expertise. One of the people who is in my film, who is also on the discussion forum, is Dr. David Adams, who was one of the original founders of an organization called Emerge in Boston that treats offenders. So there's a lot of people who are involved in that level. And then I also have Survivor Voices. And what I'm really trying to do is give survivors a forum. So there are many wonderful organizations out there, but there's this sense of a disconnect between the professionals and the research and the survivor experience, right? And the one thing that people like about my film is I have those experts, some of the leading experts in the country who have done research, talking about their research, talking about it from kind of an intellectual standpoint. And then I follow up their comments with the experience, the real life experience of 11 survivors of intimate partner violence attempts or homicide attempts, right? So it makes it more real. It also helps us paint a picture of what an abusive relationship really looks like. And far too many times we are looking for physical injury and not really paying attention to the emotional and social and financial and psychological abuse, which in the long term is much more devastating.
So it's remarkable. And the work you're doing is so appreciated. And thank you for doing it. So there's so much to talk about, and hopefully in the coming months and years, we will be supporting you and partnering with you in lots of ways to end this, that make your vision in your lifetime, my lifetime come true, that we put an end to this atrocity. Voicesforchange.net, October, you are the cover story of Incandescent Women magazine, along with a series of women that are survivors and other experts from the film, which is beautiful and gut-wrenching and heartbreaking and really just much appreciated.
For Domestic Violence Awareness Month, you can stream the film, and we're offering a buy one, gift one. So if you rent the film for $4.99, you can give it to somebody else. Our goal is to get it out there to as many people as possible, because we know that the information in there can save your life.
Yes. So October is National Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Tracy Schott is the cover story for Incandescent Women magazine, along with a series of experts and survivors. And this is our survivor issue. So we look forward to bringing lots of people in so that we can put an end to this. So thank you so much for your time this morning. I really appreciate it. And I'm sure that our viewers do too.
Well, thank you very much. And just one more word. So we've got our hashtag this month is hashtag Raise Your Voice.
Beautiful.
Thank you for allowing us to raise our voices.
Yes. Raise your voice. Help a sister, right? Thank you, Tracy. We will be in touch soon. All right.
That's it for today's episode of the Truly Amazing Women Show on the Incandescent Radio Network, the voice of entrepreneurs. If you're a truly amazing woman or know someone who is, don't hesitate to contact us. Simply log on to www.trulyamazingwomen.com and fill out the proposal form. We've profiled more than 250 women on the site who fit the bill of being truly amazing, and we look forward to honoring more. Who will be our next truly amazing woman? Tune in next week for a new episode on www.incandescentradio.com. Here's to your incredible, indelible success.